Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. Please welcome once again our head librarian, Michael Smirkanish, and his guest, Mitch Albom.
How about them lions?
First of all, I would like to apologize on behalf of my football team. We gave you every opportunity in the world. At some point, you either have to take it or we're going home. And so we went home.
And you told me backstage, you'd pretty much written your column, and then all of a sudden...
Yeah, in the last... In the last 24 hours, I've thrown away more material than I've actually printed, because I was at the Yankees-Detroit game last night, and we have at the newspaper I work for in Detroit, it's well known that we have the worst deadlines in America, always have, and so I talked to my boss, and I said, well, when do I have to file my story, thinking he would give me a time, and he said, at the bottom of the eighth, and I said... Well, you do know that baseball is nine innings, right? And he said, doesn't matter, bottom of the eighth, we have to have it. I said, let me give you a hypothetical here. What if the Tigers are winning 5-3 in the bottom of the eighth? He says, yeah. And they end up losing in the bottom of the ninth, 6-5. He said, you can phone in a couple of sentences and make an adjustment. So you basically have to write something that can hold up under whatever circumstance, and those of you who watched the game, they had a 4-0 lead going into the bottom of the ninth. That is almost as sure a thing as you can have in baseball. And so I had actually made it on time. I had written this whole column, 30, 40 inches, was going on the front page of the paper, and then we sent in Jose Valverde. And there went those 40 inches. And I had to start all over again, and I had to write a brand new column that was just thrown out. Same thing that happened today when it looked like the Lions were going to lose, and I had written the whole thing because I knew I was coming here, so I wanted to get a jump on it. And I basically ended their season because they would have been 1-4, and instead, yeah, I said they're a whopping 2-3, you know. But so that's the nature of that business. You just have, you can't marry your words. You have to let them go, and I let a lot of them go over the last 24 hours.
Mitch, there's an imager for my radio program, a guy who does the rejoinders and the show opens and so forth, and very creative guy based in Florida. And I gave him a free hand a year or so ago, and I said, we need a fresh approach to the program. Come up with something. And the approach that he came up with begins with Pink Floyd's Time, ticking away the moments that make up a dull day. You know the song. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the age of the crowd. We all know the song. And I said, well, I love it, but explain it to me. And he said, we're all so stressed. We don't have enough of that one precious commodity. And you'll hook people, he said, if you can let them know that you appreciate that their time is in such rare supply. I guess among the many things I want to ask you is, when did you gain this appreciation? Did it grow out of Tuesdays with Maury and that phase of your life?
Yeah. It grew out of that. I think before Tuesdays with Maury, which was a book that I wrote about an old college professor of mine who was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease, I really have to say that I don't think I gave life or death a second thought. I was moving at such a ridiculous pace that there really wasn't time to even consider the pace that I was moving at. And it coincided when I started to visit with him with the newspaper strike in Detroit. And consequently, I was suddenly screeched to a halt. And this pace that I had been going at really came to a stop. And on Tuesdays, I would go and sit in this guy's house all day long. No phones, no anything. And it was the beginning of my seeing, hey, wait, there's another pace that you can live your life at besides full throttle. Since then, I always say, I mean, I don't think it's a big mystery. Pretty much every book that I've written since Tuesdays with Maury is an offshoot of Tuesdays with Maury in some way, and the lessons that I learned there. And this one, The Timekeeper, referencing your question, probably began by watching Maury die, but has been, I don't know what the word would be, enhanced or made more imminent by my own parents, who have fallen into bad health in the last couple of years while I was writing this book. And, you know, I don't think anything hits your mortality more than when you see your own family enduring its evil ways. And I've watched my mom and dad, sadly, really change over the last few years. And so I'd say that had as much to do with it as Maury did.
I read outside of the book itself that your charitable work in Haiti also gave you a new sense of appreciation. How so?
Yeah, well, the funny thing about Haiti is you go down there, and I operate this orphanage down there that I go pretty much every month for 3 or 4 days. And you get there, and you can just take your watch off. I mean, nothing's functioning anyhow. I'm surprised your watch doesn't stop when you get to Haiti, because that's pretty much how the country operates. There's no electricity half the time. There's no water half the time. They can't get people on the phone. Nothing functions like that. And the children, of course, don't have any watches. They have no sense of time. All they know is, oh, it's morning. We get up. Oh, we eat. Oh, we play. Oh, we have school. And you find yourself moving at a much different pace, and you have to shut off your devices and disconnect from all that. And I found that that was very instructional, because once upon a time, that's actually how we lived. You know, we didn't always, you think about the first thing you touch in the morning. Well, that came out wrong. Wait a minute. I don't mean, something outside of your own, that's not going to work either. Just, most people, the first object that they have contact with is an alarm clock, right? I mean, something wakes you up. That's how you begin your day, with some object that says you have to get up. That's not how we were born into this world, and that's not how it works down in Haiti. So, yeah, that's been pretty instructional, too.
The timekeeper, I think, evidences a pretty healthy imagination. How natural does that come to you? How hard do you have to work to develop a fictional storyline?
You know, it was harder at the beginning, because I'd never written anything fictional before Five People You Meet in Heaven. Tuesdays with Maury it was just this incredible story that wasn't supposed to do what it did. You know, most people here, I think half of you are related to me or family anyhow, based on the number of people I called to tell I was coming, but they all know that Tuesdays with Maury was just a little labor of love that was supposed to pay Maury's medical bills. Most people turned it down. Most publishers said, we don't want it. You can't write it. You don't even know what a memoir is. And so when it came out and it did what it did, it took me as much by surprise as anybody else. And then, of course, after Tuesdays with Maury had the success that it had, all anybody wanted me to write was Wednesdays with Maury, you know, or Chicken Soup and Maury, and Things I Just Remembered Maury Told Me But I Forgot to Put in the First Book. You know, they wanted me to turn it into a cottage industry, and I was very much against that. I always felt that I said everything I had to say with that book in that book, and I refused to turn it into something that it was never intended to be just because it was doing well. And I got a little stubborn. And the more that they said they wanted that, the more it became like, I'm not going to do that. And when they finally said, all right, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I want to wait until something moves me that means as much to me as that book did. And they said, yeah, how long is that going to take? You know? And finally, I came up with a novel. And everybody said I was crazy to do it. And I probably was, because one of the biggest mistakes you can make is, if this is what you're good at, stay with it. And I, my whole life, have been a nonfiction person. You know, I had always written for newspapers or magazines, and then Tuesdays with Maury was really, at its base core, it was reportage. It was me reporting about my visits. So to imagine something out of the blue was unusual for me the first time, because I kept feeling like I needed to research it. You know, well, okay, I'm going to have Eddie, and he's going to go to heaven, and he's going to meet this guy from a carnival, but I better check my facts. You know? And so, what facts? You made the whole thing up. So it's hard to get used to that. I always say, people ask me, like, what's the difference between nonfiction and fiction? What's the better part and the worst part? And I always give this example. I say, okay, nonfiction. You're writing a story about a guy, and you go, man, this would be such an incredible, better story if he had a twin brother. But of course he doesn't, so I just have to write the way it is. Fiction. You're writing about a guy, you go, wow, this would be a better story if he had a twin brother. Hey, I can give him a twin brother. And you give him a twin brother, and then another voice in your head goes, how about a twin sister? And that's the problem. You can't shut it off. And you don't know when to tell your imagination, okay, that's enough. So that's been my biggest struggle is when to stop going out on a limb. And most of my novels, this is the third one, they all have ghosts in them and they take place in other worlds. And this one is all over the place. I have people tell me, were you on drugs when you wrote this thing? And
what do you enjoy more, fiction or nonfiction?
Well, it's a straighter road, nonfiction, because you know what the story is and you just have to serve it. It's more adventurous to write fiction. It's also a bigger gamble. It's a bit like going to a country where you don't speak the language, but you could have the greatest time, or going to, you know, another state in America where you're just going to have a fine time and it could be a great memory too, but you kind of know what you're going to get. So, I don't know, when it's going well, I guess I like fiction, you know, but when it's not, you kind of wish that you could just go check your notes.
Was there a moment with Tuesdays with Maury where you realized, I mean, a particular moment that stands out where you said to yourself, ooh, this is going to be big? Walking down a beach, walking down an airplane when somebody's reading it, or, I mean.
You mean while I was writing it?
No. When the book came out, was there that eureka moment where you said, this is really happening?
Well, I always tell the joke that Tuesdays with Maury, they published 20,000 copies total at the beginning. And they thought they'd be lucky if they get rid of those. I thought I'd have it in the trunk of my car for the rest of my life, you know. And when it began to get a little buzz about it, because Tuesdays with Maury did not come out of the gate as a big book. It came out in August, just to demonstrate this timeline. You think today if a book comes out, it's popular, it shoots to the top of the bestseller list the first week it's out. Within 3 weeks, it's already moved down. Within 2 months, it's gone. Tuesdays with Maury came out in August of 1997, didn't appear on any bestsellers list until like October, and that was way at the bottom, and went to number one in April of the next year.
Wow.
And then stayed on for 4 years. So it was sort of an unheard of thing. So I laugh when you ask the question because no one had ever seen anything behave like that before. And when they printed these 20,000 copies, I always say when they would go back to reprint, when it started to get a little buzz because people were reading it, they were very cautious and they would reprint in like quantities of eight. So I'd say, let's print up another eight. How about 10? No, that's too much. You know, just eight. So if you look in the front of Tuesdays with Maury, you'll see that it's in like its 224th printing. But it's not very impressive because, you know, the first 150 were 20,008, 20,016, 20,024, 20,000. So I would say the moment that you're asking me about is kind of related to that because I went and did the Oprah Winfrey Show. And this was, you know, you tape that show and... I wasn't a book club pick or anything like that. People sometimes think because I worked with Oprah and stuff, but I was never a book club pick. She called me to come on a show that they were doing the whole show with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross on Death and Dying, and they needed like one of those little fill-in segments at the end, little five-minute,
right.
You know, and here's a story. And so they asked me to come for that, so I went for that. And I've also told this story before, but I always say, you know, they tape in real time, and so you're not really prepared for anything. They stand backstage, they push you out on stage, they go sit down, go start. And I walked out, and Oprah Winfrey doesn't have human being furniture. She has like Gulliver furniture, and it's all tables up here and all the rest of it. And so I go out and I get into the chair, and my feet don't touch the ground. And so all I really remember of that Oprah Winfrey interview is being like this, just trying to stretch my toes, you know. So I didn't want to look like Edith Ann from Laughing, you know. And I don't even remember what I said. All I know is that I sweated through my suit in 5 minutes. Not my shirt. My shirt, okay. The outside of my suit had sweat stains on it. And I finished the interview, and the lights went off, and I was feeling like a failure, and I got out of the chair and parachuted down to the ground. And then I was walking off, and Oprah Winfrey said, oh, by the way, I'd like to make a movie out of this book. Would that be okay? And I said, okay. And that was probably the moment you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, one final question, at least for now, on that book. Are you surprised about where it pops up? And the reason I ask this, Mitch, in thinking about hosting you, sort of in the back of my mind for the last several days, I was getting caught up on Modern Family.
Ah, great show.
And in Modern Family, I think the third season, because that's where I am now, there's a Tuesdays with Maury reference. Very funny. You probably know this scene. You know, do these things happen to you where you're watching Modern Family?
And like, that's exactly what happened.
Is that right?
My wife and I were, we love that show.
Right.
And we were, it was on, and I had just left the room, and Janine said, oh my God, they just mentioned Tuesdays with Maury. And thank God for DVR, you know, because we would have had to wait till the next season or something in the old days to see it. And we went back. And if I remember correctly, the little kid, Phil and whatever her name is,
Claire,
Claire's son, is visiting this guy next door. And he's dying or something, or he dies. And they're watching him because they're concerned about his grieving process or something, how he's doing. They're watching him, and they see him come out of the house and go over to the old man's house who died and go in. And they're so impressed with his sensitivity. And she says to him, oh, my gosh, you know, one day he's going to grow up and write a book like Tuesdays with Maury. And I think Phil says, I never read that. And then as he says it, you see the kid coming out, and he says to his wife, But did that guy steal Maury's television set? Because he's walking out with his TV set.
Right. You know? True.
And I think that's pretty much how I did it. And yes, I had no idea, and they didn't call me, and they don't ask, and stuff. Jeopardy questions, I get that all the time. Oh, did you know you were a Jeopardy question? Crossword puzzles. It's amazing. I always thought they had to ask you this kind of stuff. It was in a movie with Ben Stiller called Leap of Faith with Ben Stiller and Edward Norton. It's on the shelf.
Will you engage people if you're flying home tomorrow and somebody's sitting there with a copy in the terminal, or do you just kind of smile to yourself?
Well, you know, I've tried that, and it doesn't work as well as you think it does. I don't know if it was with Tuesdays with Maury or what, but I was on an airplane, and I saw somebody reading one of my books, and they were on the aisle. So I kind of, I walked up and I said, how you like that? And they kind of look up and they go, it's all right. And you realize, you ask the question, you take your chances. So I try to stay away from that.
What did you learn about the legend of Father Time while you were writing this? Did you get to the bottom of the old man with the hourglass and where that came from?
Well, you know, when I decided I wanted to write about time, my kind of approach to things, it's the bigger the topic, the smaller the story. And I don't think, you know, time is such a weighty topic. And most of the books that I looked or even used for my research for time are all this big. I mean, they're massive. And so I wanted to do something very fairy tale-ish, just like with Five People You Meet in Heaven. I mean, heaven, afterlife, it's a massive topic. You don't need a massive book. Better a simple story. You know, we all remember Aesop's fables or small anecdotes or fairy tales as great lesson teachers sometimes in our lives. And so I knew I wanted to do something that was kind of magical about this big topic and small. And I got the idea about Father Time. I said, what's the story behind him? Maybe I can incorporate him. And when I went and did some research, and actually I did quite a bit of research for this book, you know, you're never supposed to know it, but there's a lot of very accurate history of timekeeping and timepieces and how things were invented and all the rest. And I looked up Father Time, and there's no actual story behind Father Time. He's a caricature. He's something that they use in greeting cards frequently. You know, sometimes he has an hourglass, sometimes he has a baby, sometimes he has a sickle, sometimes he has long white hair. But there's no real story. There's a little bit of vague reference to the Greek mythology of Kronos and things like that. But for the most part, there's no story. So I said, hey, this is like finding out that Superman, nobody ever said he came from Krypton or anything, and you can kind of invent where he came from. And so I thought, I'm going to invent the legend of Father Time, only in my book, he's not an old man, he's a boy. And he's the first boy on earth to begin to count the minutes. And he ruins it for everybody who came after him. And he becomes consumed with measuring. And the way that he finds out about time is the way that most historians feel that we discovered time. That somebody way, 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 way back put a stick in the ground and noticed the shadow of the sun would elongate it or change as it went by, and they began to measure the length of the shadow with a stone and then measure it again, and you're going to create, obviously, a sort of a parabola if you're following it, and that became the basic shapes for sundials. Sundials were the earliest measurement of time. I kind of have him invent almost everything because I wanted one guy, you know. So he invents a sundial, he invents a water clock, which are basically two yep. bowls, and you put water in the top and it drips through, and then when it reaches a certain level, that's how much time it is between the sun and the moon, which of course is how everybody always measured time at first in the old days. He does all that. And he becomes so consumed with measuring and counting and keeping track, much like many of us do in today's modern era, that he sort of loses touch with what's really important in his life. He has a wife, he has children, he ends up being banished, and he pays a severe price for counting the moments instead of living them.
You write early on in the book, man alone measures time, man alone times the hour, and because of this, man alone suffers a paralyzing fear that no other creature endures, a fear of time running out. In that same portion of the book, you also, and I referenced this when I had the privilege of having you on my radio show, you also made the observation that a dog does not check his watch. I thought about that because the last dog that we lost, I sort of got this feeling that she knew and had some concept of time at that late stage.
It's actually hunger, I think. Most dogs have a sense of hunger. We attribute characteristics to animals because we think that, you know, we are the most important creatures on the planet, so how could they not? But mostly dogs just get hungry, you know, and animals get hungry. And I do believe they have a sense of seasons and things like that, but they're not counting their days. They don't know it's Tuesday. They don't know that they're late for an appointment. And there's a certain envy, you know, that I have. Where I live, it's kind of a wooded area in Michigan, and there's frequently deer that run across our backyard, and we always, my wife or I, we're always yelling, deer! You know, it's like everything has to stop. You know, we run out there just to look at them because they're so magnificent. And I watch them lope along and they stop. And at one point while I was writing the book, that's what inspired that paragraph. I said, that deer has no idea what time it is and doesn't care.
And you're envious of that deer.
Absolutely. I wanted to take off my watch and put it on his paw and see how he liked it, you know.
When I go to the movies with my wife, she has to explain to me what they meant. I'm there for the gratuitous sex and violence. And she tells me what the messages were. So let's review your messages, okay? Because here's what I take away.
What about the gratuitous sex and violence? There's so much of it.
I missed that.
Yeah, me too.
So the note that I wrote in trying to get into the message, I write, or you wrote, and I paraphrase, the funny thing about humans, in the end, we think it all passed too quickly, and yet during the journey, we often think it's moving too slowly, and that's what Sarah and Victor are there to illustrate.
That's right. Yeah, Sarah and Victor are two extremes that Father Time, this boy, Dor, who is banished to a cave for his invention. Basically, God punishes him for counting this precious gift that he's given, but he doesn't kill him. Instead, he lets him live forever. He says, you want time? Guess what? You have all the time in the world, and you're never going to age, but you're going to live in this cave, and you're going to listen to all the complaints of all the people who come after you complaining about time, this thing that you invented. And eventually, when he's broken, he's basically a broken man. And he's given up any illusions about counting anymore. He hates the fact that he invented clocks. He hates the fact that he started counting. He only wants his memories back. He carves them on the wall. And when he finishes carving his life on the wall and he reaches sort of the last symbol of his life, that's when an angel returns and says, okay, it seems that you have learned your lesson. Now we're going to find out. And the angel sends him back to Earth with an hourglass, and his charge is to find two people. One very young, Sarah, who's a teenage girl, and one very old, Victor, who's a tycoon a la Warren Buffett. And he needs to teach each of them the true meaning of time. And each of them has a particular problem with it. Sarah is a teenage girl with a crush on a boy who doesn't really care about her. She has her heart broken. She gets embarrassed on the internet, and she wants to die. And her dilemma to Father Time is she wants to give her time back. It's not her time to go, but she doesn't want any more of it. And he needs to straighten her out. Victor is one of these guys who's wealthy in his 80s, and he gets sick, and he decides the world can't possibly live without him because he's too important. And so instead of dying, he's going to freeze himself cryonically before he dies. Normally, and I did a lot of research because it just so happens that the Cryonics Institute is in my backyard. Not my actual backyard, but it's about 20 minutes from me in Michigan. So I went there and did a tour, which I'll tell you about if you want to know. It's kind of creepy because, you know, it's sort of an indoor cemetery. I mean, you see these big cylinders, giant cylinders.
Did you see the Ted Williams?
Well, he wasn't in that one. Ted's head is someplace special. But there are a lot of other
people. Are there names on them, like a locker room?
Well, what's interesting is each big cylinder has about five or six people in it. And it's just big. It looks like a nuclear power thing, you know, but not that large. And they're hung upside down because apparently if anything should go wrong, the head is the most important thing to preserve. And so they're just suspended upside down, frozen inside these things. And you're walking around and they are not marked. However, there is a box on the ground and the cylinders are numbered and the boxes have numbers. And in the boxes were flowers, some of them, for people who had come to the grave, so to speak, and left flowers for number two cylinder or number six cylinder. And I mean, very much like a cemetery. And I wrote about all this in the book, and I describe how, you know, he thinks about his wife coming to bring flowers and put in a little box and sit on a couch and look at a cylinder, you know, and he realizes she's never going to do it. And that's one of the reasons he keeps a secret from her. But he wants to live forever. He wants to come back and have a whole nother lifetime. And Father Time is charged with teaching him. That's not the way it works either. You can't take too much time. You have what you have. And so those are the two sort of extremes.
What was the inspiration for Sarah? Who or what was the inspiration for Victor? Because you could have come up with all sorts of combinations and composites to tell the story. Why those profiles?
Well, I knew I wanted two extremes. The model for Sarah is actually a lot of my teenage nieces. Janine and I got married pretty late, so we weren't able to have kids, but we have so many children in our lives. We have 17 nieces and nephews that are always around, and we've gone through every one of their teenage years with them. And I always like observing teenage girls because I like the way they talk and that whole rhythm and like this, like that. You know? And it's just kind of, it's bouncy and it's got a nice rhythm. If you're a musician, like, you know, I once was, you kind of enjoy the whole beat of the whole thing. You know, and they're so effusive, but then they're so upset. And then there's everything's so emotional, you know, oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I love it. I love it. I hate it. I hate it. And so, but I've noticed amongst all this emotion, they get very upset. I mean, when they get sad, they really get sad. And it scares me. I've worried for some of my nieces sometimes how upset they are over things that you want to take them and you go, you have no idea. You won't even remember his name 2 years from now. And they want to kill themselves. So I thought, well, you know, you can't just always talk about time on the far end of it, about death and what do you want. This is also an issue with time. And you need to trust it. And one of the things that he says to her, Father Time says to her, when he shows her the future if she kills herself. It's a bit of like a Christmas carol almost. And she doesn't realize all the lives she's going to affect by doing this because, you know, teenage kids are often very selfish. Their problems are just their problems. And they think that no one would ever be affected. And he says to her, you can't turn your back on the time that you're given. Because if you do that, you give back the greatest gift that God has given you in life. And she says, what's that? He says, hope. And it's true. You know, if you bury your tomorrow, you're basically saying, I have no hope. And that's not our privilege. Much as we may feel it, I think God gives us our time for a reason. And if he's not taking it from you, there may be a reason that tomorrow holds something that you don't know that today does. And so I wanted to get that lesson across.
How about with Victor? By the way, is it Delamonte or Delamont?
Delamont.
When I read it, I never...
In my mind, it
how
was
do you
Delamont.
Say it?
Delamont.
Delamont.
Victor Delamont, a French tycoon.
14th, right? Richest man in the world?
14th richest man in the world, yeah. I didn't know who the other 13 would be. Just right about, 14th richest man in the world. And he's got a little of me in him, at my worst, in that he thinks he can problem solve his way out of anything. And he determines, he gets cancer, and he tries to beat cancer, and then he says, I'm too smart to get into this game of trying to beat cancer. That's what everybody does. I got to beat immortality, and that's what he attacks, and that's how he finds his way to cryonics. And so he is sort of an amalgamation of all of our current surging, urging desire to live longer and more and be bigger and go on and on. It wasn't so long ago that to live 40 years was a life. And somehow people dealt with it. Now we live 80 years and everybody feels like we're running out of time. There's got to be something to that equation, and he is sort of the symbol of that.
And Dore, you've already spoken of, but do you want to say anything else about developing that character?
Well, the thing about Dore, who is Father Time, that he doesn't get until he has it taken away, is how much he loves his wife. And that is 100% me. And, I am absolutely blessed with the best wife in the world, and every day that goes by, I appreciate her more, and I probably was at my least appreciative when I married her, and I said to her, I'm kind of apologizing to you with this book, because he doesn't realize until she's gone, and all he wants is to have her back in his life, and she dies early on in the book, and that's what makes him say, I want to stop time, because he can't figure out how to save her, and so he figures, why can't I make time stop? If I've been measuring it, if I've been doing this, why can't I make time stop? And it's that desire that propels him to this banishment that he has. And the whole book, he's longing to be with his wife again. And that's my love letter to Janine. And of course, the wife is like this wonderful, perfect, giving, loving, she gets sick because she's helping these poor people who come and they have the plague, and she feeds them and she takes care. That's exactly what my wife would do, and I'd be there going, don't touch him, don't touch him. And so that's probably,
Did you read the last lecture, Randy Pausch's book, Jeff Zaslow?
I knew Jeff.
And I had the privilege of hosting him for book club, as a matter of fact, and we lost Jeff as well. You knew the book.
Yeah, I can't say I read it, as carefully as a lot of other people did.
Because I thought a lot about that book while I was reading this book. Similar themes of appreciation of time and how to approach it.
Yeah, well, I think anybody who gets older starts to have some version of that. Maybe not as lyrical as the last lecture or whatever I write, but everybody starts to have those thoughts. And to me, the essence of the story that I was trying to tell, and I realize now that I hope all of you have gotten the book because we've pretty much ruined the whole thing for you. But the essence of the story is when Dore, Father Time, has to confront the old man, Victor, and when he sees what his future would hold, and how this idea of coming back for another lifetime isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And he says to him, there's a reason that God limits your days. And of course, Victor, being who he is, can't understand why anything bad would ever, And he says, well, what could possibly be the reason? And Father Time says, to make each one of them precious. And that, to me, is the lesson that I realized and that I wanted to get across in the book. Because as I struggle with my parents' illnesses, with the deaths of my wife's sister, Debbie, and who basically was a sister to me, and illnesses of a lot of people who were very close to me and deaths of a lot of people who were close to me, you do find that you're questioning all the time, why death? Why do you have to take people? You know, you look up and you say, why? It was a good person. Why? And the conclusion that I have reached is that God, in his sort of infinite, amazing arithmetic, has created this scenario where if you understand that your days are limited, then they become precious. If all you do is fight against them being limited and try to push them out and extend them and think you can beat it, you may not spend them the way you're supposed to be spending them. And all you have to do is realize that God did it for a reason, and you will probably have better days. And so you can live. I mean, there's a reason that we don't live forever. If we live forever, nothing would matter at all. You could spend 1 million years as a thief and 1 million years as a priest. What would be the difference? You have forever. But because you get a limited amount of time and you don't even know how long that's going to be, you have to make a choice. Am I going to be the priest or am I going to be the thief? You know, what am I going to be? And how am I going to spend my life? And the quality of those decisions determines the quality of your days. So that's why some people can live till 100 and barely touch anybody, hardly make a dent, you know. And other people, kids, they're taken when they're 12, 15. But somehow in their short journey on earth, they inspired, you know, thousands of people. It's not, to quote a cliche, it's not counting the hours. It's making the hours count. And that's sort of, you know, the essence of the book. So now I've summed it up. You can buy a John Grisham book instead.
Before you leave the theme, would you mind reading from page 47? Because you've just addressed a part that I really enjoyed.
You sound like a rabbi when you say that. We're going to read page 47 collectively. Responsively. Doris shook his head there.
Yeah, from there down.
Oh. So this is... This is when Father Time, this is when Dor first is banished to the cave. And the angel, this old man, is trying to figure out why he spent so much time on earth counting. And he's been crying, Dor, because he's banished to this cave. And his tears are on the floor of the cave, and they're glowing blue. His tears are glowing blue. And... So Father Time says to him, why did you measure the days and nights? This is the angel says to him, why did you measure the days and nights? Dor looked away. To know, he answered. And what do you know, the old man asked, about time? Dor shook his head. He had never heard the actual word before. What answer would suffice? The old man held out a bony finger, then made a swirling motion. The stains from Dor's tears gathered together, forming a pool of blue on the rocky floor. Learn what you do not know, the old man said. Understand the consequences of counting the moments. How? Dor asked. By listening to the misery it creates. He lowered his hand into the tear stains. They liquefied and began to glow. Small wisps of smoke appeared on the surface. Dor watched, confused and overwhelmed. His voice choked in a whisper. Please, let me die. I have no wish to go on. The old man rose. The length of your days does not belong to you. You will learn that as well. He placed his hands together and became the size of a boy, then an infant. Then he lifted like a bee taking flight. Wait, Dor yelled. Wait! How long must I be imprisoned here? When will you return? The old man's shrunken form reached the cave roof. It sliced a fissure in the rock, and from that fissure felt a single drop of water. When heaven meets earth, he said, and he became nothing. That's it. Yeah. You know, for the first time, I did not read this book on tape. When Tuesdays with Maury was published, it was so small that they didn't have a budget to go get an actor or anybody else to read it. And so they came to me and they said, would you read this book for a book on tape? In those days, it was tape, was really tape. And I said, okay. And it was a very weird experience because I had the print out of the book, and they came to my house with a tape recorder, and we sat in the basement. And a woman, they just sent one woman, and she sat behind me, and I had the pieces of paper. I had like page 1, 2, 3, and you could only do 3 at a time because they didn't want to hear the noise of the paper rattling. And I would read it, but I couldn't see her because she was behind me. And I would read it, and if she didn't like what I did, she would just go, "Again, please." And you never knew when it was going to come. So you'd be reading, and when I saw Maury, I said, "Again, please." And it never wavered. It was always that, "Again, please." It was always polite. And it started to become like Chinese water torture, you know? Is it going to drop? Is it, she going to say, "Again, please"? "Again, please." And you reach the end, you go, "I made it," you know? So after I did that, it became kind of popular, I guess, and people liked when authors read their own stuff. So I ended up reading The 5 People You Meet in Heaven because the lead character in that, Eddie, was based on an uncle of mine named Eddie who talked like this and didn't, "I don't mean nothing. I never did nothing." And I could do that, although my throat hurt for like 3 weeks after I read that. And then I read For One More Day, which is really kind of a story about me and my mom. And then I read Have a Little Faith, which was a story about a Rabbi Albert Lewis, who many of you know across the river in Beth Sholem in New Jersey. But this book, I felt that it was very epic. And, you know, it dealt with the beginning of time and it went into the future and all that. And I thought, we need a Brit, you know? We need a guy with a British accent. And so they got this actor from Downton Abbey, that PBS show.
Which one?
Dan Stevens.
Who does he play?
Who does he play? He plays the young, handsome guy, I'm told. I don't watch it, so I don't know. He's involved with a woman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Anybody know? Dan Stevens. Very good. And he gives a scene. "Then Father Time lifted the hourglass and said," that's perfect. That's what you want. It's like Lord of the Rings, you know?
Mitch, take me into the room where you wrote what you just read. Is it a room in the house? What's on the wall? Is the plot line there? Are you on a computer? Are you writing longhand? Is there a window? Paint it for me.
Well, there in my house, there are three places that I write. One is in the basement. The basement, the basement, the basement. There is nothing on the wall. I think there's a picture of the Beatles. And it's got no windows, and it's got some musical instruments in it. And I just squeeze into a little space because I'm used to writing in little contained spaces anyhow. That's one. The second is my office, which I built on the ground floor of my house. I'm surrounded by books, just books, books, books. It's like a library. It's very wood, you know, dark wood and dark carpet. It's got a little fireplace, and it's got a window that looks out onto the snow most of the time, because if you live in Michigan 8 months a year, you're looking at snow. And the last place is at the kitchen table. And sometimes, because I just want to be around my wife, and she doesn't come down, so if she's futzing around upstairs, I'll just go sit there. And, you know, we're silly, stupid. Like it's like we're one of those people, those couples that you might not talk for an hour, and you're in the same room. And then she goes to another room and goes, "Where are you going?" You know.
Did you map the whole book out? Did you know where you were going, or did you just...
That didn't interest you at all, did it? I was going that whole romantic route, and did you map the book out? No. I don't map... I tell you what I do, Michael. I'm just teasing you.
Of course.
That's my friend Rosie, who's, you know, one of my dear, dear, dear friends, and he works with me out in Detroit. He comes out on Monday, and he lives here in Jersey, but he comes out on Monday, and he spends the week with me, and he produces the radio show, and he takes care of a charity where he's fantastic. But he's been doing this for about 10 years, and I had to say to him, because he discovered this in the first year, you can't tease people in the Midwest the way that you can tease here in Philadelphia and New Jersey. They don't get it, you know? So you say, you know, you walk in and you think you got a relationship with someone and the guy's wearing like a pink shirt and you go, "Nice shirt." And they go, thanks. You know, and you're totally off. And so I know I'm in the East. I can tease you,
you
a little
can.
Bit. I wouldn't
Absolutely.
Have done that if you were the if you were a Midwest host. But as far as mapping stuff out, I have a lot of novelist friends, and I really admire them. People like Amy Tan and Stephen King, these people that I've met through this band that we played it with. And periodically we'll talk about, you know, kind of how we approach stuff. And they always say things like, well, I just kind of get into the premise and I let the characters take me where I'm going to go. And I look at them like, I say, you got to be kidding me. See, my characters, if I said, where are we going to go? They'd get in the drawer, they'd go, I don't know. You created us. What are you asking us for? You know? So I have to have kind of a North Star. I have to know the ending that I sail towards. I don't have to know all the middle, but I have to know where I'm going. I knew the end of The Five People You Meet in Heaven before I ever sat down to write the book. In fact, when I went to go tell the story, because nobody was very interested, as I said, in me writing a novel. Everybody wanted me to write another book, and I had the toast of the town when after Tuesdays with Maury, because I had only had one book contract for Tuesdays with Maury, because it was a one-off. So I wasn't obligated to any publisher, and when it came time to do a follow-up of Tuesdays with Maury, all those people who told me to get lost now were having me over for lunch, you know? But they all wanted a nonfiction book. And I had this novel, and I would go and I would tell them the story. And when I went to this publisher, Hyperion, and we sat in an office, and there were about six people in the office, the publisher, a bunch of different editors, a number of women, and I knew the end of the story. And so I talked a little about the beginning, talked about Eddie dying, talked about him going to heaven. He meets one person, second person, and the last person he meets, and I knew who it was going to be, is this little girl who he inadvertently killed during the war and didn't know about it. And he asks her what he asked all the other people. Did I save this girl at an amusement park? I felt her hands. And this little girl says, you pushed her out of the way. And he says, no, I couldn't have pushed her out of the way because I felt her hands in my hands. And she says, those were my hands. I was bringing you to heaven. And when I said that in that room, one of the women burst into tears. She just exploded into tears. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. And then she, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And when I left, I was with my literary agent. I said to her, I said to him, I want to be published here, and I want that woman to be my editor. And she was, and we did. And she edited the next three books with me.
Wow. That's a great story.
Yeah. So,
Mitch. So how are you at, as we would say in the East, walking the walk and talking the talk? Are you living the lesson of a book like this, or are you struggling with it yourself? I mean, I told you on the radio and when we finally got the chance to say hello that I feel like I have a great work ethic, and then I feel like a malingerer when I read what you're juggling at the same time. How do you do it?
Well, first of all, I have always tried to caution people that I don't write books from on high. Starting with Tuesdays with Maury, there will be people who will come up to me and say, Maury, can I ask you a question? And I always have to stop them and say, I'm not Maury. I was the stupid one, remember? I was the one who needed to learn the lessons. I don't have the answers. And I have essentially been fighting that same fight with my books ever since. It may sound odd, Michael, but I begin every book with the idea of what do I need to learn? And then I see if it's something that other people might need to learn too. So the answer to your question is I am a failed student at almost everything I write about and write to try to lecture myself and remind myself about these lessons. And as I'm writing the book, I often become better at the thing that it is that I'm writing about. Have a Little Faith, for example, brought me much closer to my faith and to others and to understand it. For One More Day, which was an idea I had about a guy who gets a day back with his mother years after she passed away, was something that I felt that I needed to say to my own mother And as it turned out, you know, I wasn't going to write that book. I had another book that was, I was kind of already started and was on. And I was talking to my mom one morning on the phone, and I hung up the phone. And we'd had a nice conversation. She called me every morning. We were laughing. And when I hung up the phone, I said to myself, I know there's going to be a day when I'm going to reach for that phone and I'm going to have to take my hand back because my mom's not going to be around. And that ended up, that day I changed the focus of the book that I was writing, and I started writing For One More Day, which really was a couch story of me and my mom. And I gave it to her when it came out. Of course, my mom being what she is, I put her picture in the back of the book, you know, kind of to dedicate, just to say, you know, with love to my mom or something. And I gave her the book. She didn't know what I was writing. She had no idea. I never told her about it or anything. When it was finished, I gave it to her. I got the first copy and I gave it to her. I said, go read this and come back and tell me what you think. It's a lot of stuff I want to say, I've wanted to say to you. And she read it. She came back. She said, oh, it's wonderful. I said, yeah. She said, oh, my favorite part is my picture at the back of the book. Which I probably should have seen coming. But as it turned out, a few years later, before my next book, she had a stroke that robbed her of the ability to speak. And so if I had waited one more book, I would never have had that experience of being able to share that with her and know. So these books are mostly for me. And then if they find a universality with other people, I'm glad. I wish I could say, oh, yes, I have time all figured out. I got it perfectly balanced, but I don't. I wish I could say that I learned every single lesson that Maury taught me, and I live the Maury life, but I don't. And he didn't either. Not every minute. But I'm trying. That's all I think you can say in life, is that I'm trying. I believe the things I say. I believe the things I write. I've paid an enormous price, more than anybody will ever know, for what you admire about me. And if I could do it again, I would never do it at that pace, and I would never do it at that accumulation. And hopefully I'll get a number more years to be able to balance that out. So sometimes when people say, you know, nice things like that to me, or their kids will say, well, I want to do what you do when I get older, I always say, shoot higher. You know, because it's not that.
A final subject from me, and then we'll see what's on some folks' minds. You referenced cryogenics. You were careful in the acknowledgments at the end not to disparage that whole industry, if that's the right word. And so you left me kind of wondering, okay, what does Mitch Albom really think about that whole process? You know, Dorr and Victor have an unpleasant experience at the end of the book. And then comes the acknowledgement. Maybe that was just a thank you because these kind folks had let you in the door.
Yes. I believe in being polite. I don't think there's anything the matter with that. And I don't think you need to be mean, to be successful. And, they were kind enough to share their time with me. They're sincere. They believe that this is science. This is the natural end of science. They believe that, and let's face it, it's never worked because the reanimation has never been, no one's ever figured that part of it out. But they certainly are correct that if you said, well, whooping cough, you know, they're never going to find a cure for that. Tuberculosis, they'll never find a cure for that. Well, they did. And if there was some way that was all that was holding you back, and then you could somehow be cured of that, that's what they're dreaming of. Now, no one has figured out how to bring someone back, but they're counting on that in the future. And I found them to be sincere, if not a little odd.
I thought it was a little pale
also. They're inside a lot, you know.
It struck me as a bit selfish because, okay, who am I coming back with? The other guys in that tube, I don't even know them.
Well, me personally, I have no interest in spending any more time in cold weather than I already have. You know, I've done enough of that. And I don't believe, I don't want to be around when nobody I love is around? What's the point? You know, so if I had my druthers, and I'm sure this is true of everybody here, everybody I love, we'd all go at the same day, you know. And until then, we'd all be around for each other. It wouldn't be this attrition that life seems to feel like now, just one gone and one gone. So I have no belief in it. I think it's rather odd and not really what God wants. And I don't think we should monkey around with that. But I also believe that people are entitled to think what they think and what they do. And as I say, they were nice enough to let me come in there recently. I'm not going to go, well, thanks a lot for that. Watch me slam you now. Ha ha. You know, it's okay to be nice.
No doubt. Questions for Mitch Albom. Terry?
Mitch, what's the role of religion, your faith, in all these writings? Solid philosopher?
What's the role of faith in these writings? Well, it's probably changed over the years because in Tuesdays with Maury, Maury was Jewish by birth and certainly by culture, but he went kind of out of his way to not be very Jewish or any one religion, and I felt that it would be disingenuous to portray him as such. And so if I've ever heard any criticism of Tuesdays with Maury, and I don't often, but it'll be like, well, why is there more about his faith? And I always said, well, because that really wasn't part of it. What I learned from that, though, was that people like that, because Tuesdays with Maury became, for Christians, one thing, for Jews, one thing, for Hindus, for Buddhists, everybody found something that they could relate to with Tuesdays with Maury. When I wrote The Five People You Meet in Heaven, having learned that lesson, I think I kind of deliberately kept it very general. So it's about heaven. I mean, what is really more a faith-based topic than where we go after we die? Many feel that that's the reason religion became what it became for man. I wanted to make sure that I didn't turn people off by saying, this is what happens for one particular faith. Of course, you do that, then your Jewish friends say, well, you know, why didn't you say you go to Olam Haba, you know? And your Christian friends say, how come Jesus isn't the first person to meet you? And, you know, and my answer is, it's a fable, you know? I'm not writing the definitive book on faith here. So really, until Have a Little Faith, I kind of stayed away from it as a deliberate thing. I have my views, obviously, but I don't believe that my particular religious views were what I was trying to write, and so therefore I didn't think that they had a place. Have a Little Faith was a whole different experience. I had to confront my history. I was raised by most standards, very religiously in terms of Judaism. I went to a Kiba Academy here up in Lower Merion. They have a new name for it now, but that's what they call it then. What's it called?
Jack Barrack. Right. I spoke there recently. Yeah.
And, you know, I spent half the day speaking another language, you know, and I could read ancient transcripts and rabbinical commentaries and all that. And then I kind of walked away from it. When I got into my 20s, I kind of had nothing to do with it other than the periodic return to synagogue for high holidays once or twice a year. And then I was sort of thrown back into it with Have a Little Faith in these visits to my old rabbi, Albert Lewis. My wife is Christian, and, you know, so I'm totally exposed to that world. Most of where I live in Michigan is and most of the people I know are Christian-based. This mission that we, the orphanage that we operate in Haiti is Christian-based. And so I've had to move between a lot of faiths. And on top of that, Detroit has got the largest Arab population in the world outside of the Middle East. So, my personal faith doesn't often enter into the books other than what I believe is sort of a universal, elements of what God wants, and how I understand it. I don't think that God wants us to be spending every minute counting or measuring or doing all that kind of stuff. And we do, and I do too much of it. I don't think we're supposed to be, you don't go to heaven like this. I'm sure of that. I'm just sure when you get to those gates that there's nobody out there going, let me check you in. Hang on a second. Have you got the iPad 30? You know? Oh, you don't have it down there. Oh, yeah. So, I don't, you know, and that's how it sort of weaves in. But I'm very guarded about telling people what faith should be. I believe that everybody has to come to that on their own. However, there's a lot of spirituality in my books, and I guess, you know, because I feel that way about my own life. So faith is very important to me personally, but I don't think I should be lecturing people about it, you know.
Yes, ma'am, right here. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Have you ever considered writing in a voice for children? I know you heard that, but podcast folks will want to hear this.
Oh, podcast. Well, you know, I've been asked to do that multiple times. And my answer is always, what's the voice for children? I never quite get that. I also find that when I go out and meet people, I have kids as young as 10 years old who are reading Tuesdays with Maury and the five people we meet in heaven. They seem to like that one the best. The 10-year-olds. By the time they're 12, they're up to Tuesdays with Maury. And I'm apparently already writing at a pretty juvenile level. I don't know how much simpler I can get. So I always felt that it would be kind of forced, you know, almost like going gaga, goo, goo, gaga, you know, to write a book. But I know that there's a large audience out there of young readers. And if someone could ever figure out for me how you do that without looking like you're aiming at it. You know, like I think no knock on James Patterson. I'm sure he's a good guy. I've met him a couple times. But you know, it seemed to me like when he came up with that whole Maximum Rides, it was just like, let's capitalize on this market. And I don't want to be like that. Either you have something to say or you don't. And how can I say something to young people? What is it that they need to hear? This book was sort of my first foray into that with this teenage girl. And so whenever I meet teenage girls who get this book, I say, please email me back once you finish. Tell me how I did. You know, I've never written a teenage girl before. Did I get the essence of her? Did I capture her? And, you know, I've been curious to see that most people think that I actually got it pretty good. Some people come up and say, I can't believe that. You don't have kids? You don't have a teenage girl? I said, well, we have them around, you know, and maybe if I can find something like that to do, I would definitely consider it. I love working with children and I love reaching out to them. I just don't want to be phony about it. And so far, I've never found a way to say, okay, not this voice, this voice, without it seeming like you were just aiming at them, you know. As you get older, you don't want to be those people that pretends to be cool, you know, so.
Second row? Yeah.
Mitch, hi. My name's Dave. I love you.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Surprises, the unexpected. Has someone ever come up to you after any of your books and just maybe blown you away with something that has happened in their life as a result of any inspiration from any books?
Yeah.
What inspiration have you provided for folks? I did a terrible job of synthesizing David's great question.
Well, David asked if I've ever been surprised by people coming up to me and saying, as a result of your book, fill in the blank. The answer is yes, endlessly. First time I remember it happening, I was in Chicago, and Two Sisters of Moria had been out for about a year, and a guy came up at a book signing, and he was trembling, and he grabbed my arm, and he started to shake like this, and there were some people around, and they thought he was going to attack me or something. It looked like one of those situations. And he started to cry. And I instinctively knew I wasn't in any danger. And I said, I said, no, it's okay, it's okay. And eventually, when he got his voice back, he was weeping. He said, my wife died yesterday. And the last thing we did was read your book together. And I thought by coming here, I would just feel a little closer to, can I just hold on to you for a couple more minutes? I'm sorry, I get a little choked up. I tell that story, but that's when you know you're not writing sports books anymore, you know? And so, I mean, that's probably the biggest example, but there have been endless things like that. People who have reconnected with their family members, people who have not talked to somebody for a long time, and than they did as a result of it. One guy said to, came up to me, and he, after five people you meet in heaven, and he said, how did you know? How did you know? I said, what are you talking about? How did you know? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, my sister was in a coma for, I don't know, a year, 2 years. We went and visited her all the time. And when one day I wasn't going to go, and I went, and I sat down next to her bed, and she came out of the coma for 10 seconds, and her eyes opened, and she said, home. And then she shut her eyes, and she died. And the last word of the five people you meet in heaven is exactly that, that Eddie hears all these people who he affected on earth joining in a collective voice and a word, I forget how I wrote it, but something in a collective voice and a single word from God, home. And he somehow thought that I and she were connected because I had, you know, and I had to say to him, it's just coincidence, you know, but he didn't see it that way. He said, no, that's what you, that's what happens at the end. That's what you think. That's the word. That's what you say. I saw it with my own eyes, with my sister, and you must know something like that because you didn't. Weird stuff like that. So a lot of it happens is the answer to your question.
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name's Andy. Thanks for the great conversation, Mark. I'm curious, it seems like sports is a very big part of your life and your career, and you have all these wonderful books. Is there any sort of bridge connection between these books?
What connects all your work?
Well, between sports and this, virtually nothing. I've never really been able to explain that to people, except that I know the difference because, like, women will come up to me and they'll say, my husband loves you on Sports Reporters, you know, and men will come up to me and say, my wife loves your books, you know, but, you know, that's kind of a left-handed compliment, isn't it? You know, hey, Mitchell, my wife loves your books. I personally don't read a thing, you know. So I've kind of gotten used to that. Like, I definitely exist in these different worlds to different people. There are people out there who have, well, there's three groups. There's the men who have no idea I do anything other than sports. There's the women who have no idea that I do anything other than these five books. And then there's the international crowd who can't, they don't know what I am. You know, they go on the web and they go, I came to this website, fine to, you know, with the language all backwards, you know, and all I find sports piece. Please give me Maury Tuesday, you know, like that. And there's all that. So I've given up trying to make sense to anybody. It doesn't make sense to me either. I'm in sports because I was birthed in sports and, you know, I always felt that I shouldn't walk away from that job just because I had some success in other things. Detroit's a town that, you know, I mean, this is my home. I grew up here in New Jersey. I'm born and raised here. I'll always be a Jersey Philly kid. But I've been in Detroit for a long time now, and it really is my now adopted home. And you know, they're always used to people leaving. Everybody leaves. In fact, the first day I went to work there, and this is now 27 years ago, I've been working at that newspaper. They ran a little story about me coming to the newspaper. And when I got to the place, I hadn't written a word yet. And there was a letter waiting for me. Somebody had already written. I'm thinking already they hate me. I haven't written anything. And I opened the letter, and it was this beautiful, kind, welcoming letter saying, read a little story about you coming. Hope you enjoy Detroit. You know, glad that you're coming. Sounds like you got a great background. We know you're not going to stay because none of the good ones ever do. But while you're here, we hope you enjoy your time. And I never forgot that. That was the first letter that ever greeted me there, and they just assumed I was going to leave because a lot of people with talent, if they have it, usually they're right. Many of them do. I always felt that that wasn't right. They gave me my opportunity. They gave me my chance. So when Tuesdays with Maury came along and all of a sudden this whole other world opened up, instead of walking away from that job, I kept it, and I've kept it ever since. I can now say I probably stayed too long at the fair, you know, and maybe I wasn't so smart, but I do know that it was motivated for the right reason, that I wanted to stay loyal to my community, and sports is huge in Detroit. I mean, you know, nobody wants to be on the front page. You know, when they would take my column and say, we're going to put it on the front page, And I'd say, no, leave it where it is. You know, it's better in the sports section because people take the paper and they rip the, you know, they go right to the sports section in Detroit. So I've never been able to bridge those two worlds. Once in a while, I'll run into an athlete. He'll be, you know, 400 pounds and he'll be in a jock strap and he'll be going through the thing. And he'll say, hey, read your book. Not bad. And they'll surprise you, you know.
Another question? Over here, yes, sir.
Yes, working on the book, doing it, did you come, of course, the concept of kairos, which is the opposite of chronos, meaning the acceptable time of God's appointed time, and how did that fit into your own?
Yes, I've read about that, and destiny, and a lot of it, but what I wanted to create with this character was sort of an ancient version of the type A personality. And so what I wanted Dor to cover, I guess, were the qualities of being infatuated with the measuring. And so I stayed away from that element of it because it wasn't really tied in with what I was trying to do. He is sort of, you know, if he were in our time, he would have been working at Apple, you know, or Google, you know, and go in at 6 a.m. and stay there 7 days a week and just be so fascinated by the new. And one of the things I enjoyed with this character was he comes back to Earth in 2012 with this hourglass, and he hasn't seen the world since ancient Babylonia, you know, and but with this hourglass, he can... He just tilts it slightly and everything semi-freezes. Not totally, but enough that you wouldn't know he was there. And he teaches himself the world while everybody's frozen. So if he came into this room, he'd just tilt it and he'd walk around, take care of everybody's glasses and take their coat and take a look at their thing. And then he'd let it go just a little bit and listen to the language and he'd teach himself the language. And as I say, at one point he taught himself, he spent 100 years in a single day. And he taught himself the modern world. And he's so repelled by what we've done with time and how we've taken his invention and gone to atomic clocks think about how many things in the course of your morning measure time from the time you get up, the alarm clock, your phone, the television, your computer screen. Before you ever get to work, you've been reminded of the time probably 20 times. And then you go to work, which reminds you of the time all the time. So, that was really what I was more trying to do than capture the old Greek, you know, balance.
Two more, because Mitch is going to sign some books then. Way in the back. Can't, there you are. Hi.
Hi. I'm 16 years old, not loved, by people you meet in heaven.
Thank you.
And I'm really into writing fictional books. What would be your advice to somebody who wants to write?
Well, as simple as it sounds, read. I can't believe how many people just want to sit down and start writing who really don't read a lot. And you would never think about becoming a musician without listening to music, right? And you can't really just say, okay, I've got the English language. Somebody taught me the basics. I know how to type. I'm going to be a writer. The best advice I ever received about all the fields that I ended up in, be they music or writing or directing or filming or any of these things, came from, I was working as a security guard for Pinkerton back in my days when I was a starving musician in New York because I started in music. And I got assigned to a photographer. It wasn't Scavullo, but it was somebody just like Scavullo, you know, real big photographer. He took that famous picture of Woody Allen for Time Magazine and Warren Beatty on the cover of Time Magazine. You remember this? He was that guy. Anyhow, I was assigned to guard him or protect him. Clearly, he was in no danger. I have pictures of me in this Pinkerton outfit. Honestly, someone once saw me with my little hat and the blue thing. I said, what is that, Halloween? I look like someone who would go with a trick-or-treat bag and ask you. And Pinkerton, I was assigned in, and I worked in Harlem, and this is when I was in New York, and I was trying to, you know, make money as a musician. And my assignment in Harlem, I worked from 10 p.m. till 4 a.m. in Spanish Harlem, up at 162nd in Amsterdam, guarding a museum. And I sat in a latrine. This is a God's honest truth. I'm going to answer your question somehow. But I sat in a latrine, and it had a light bulb, and you sat on the toilet, you know, which was closed, and that's where I waited. And then every hour, I had to walk around the building, and I had a clock in with a little thing that showed that I had protected this museum from who's going to break into a museum in Spanish Harlem? What is there to take? But it was amazing because I wore this little Pinkerton outfit, and I would walk along, you know, at my 5'8", and guys would scatter, you know. They just, the drug addicts and guys on the bench, and they just run, you know, because they see blue and they think you're a cop. And I said, if you only knew, you know, I don't have any weapons on me. They used to say at Pinkerton, your weapon is a dime. Make a phone call, you know. And one night after my shift ended, it was 4 a.m., and I took the subway home because I was young and stupid. And I went down to the subway, and all of a sudden, I hear this woman screaming in Spanish. And she's yelling, and she's, and I come running over, and I can make out that she's been robbed, that somebody just robbed her. And she's pointing, go, policia, policia. Go. So I go chasing, and I go, and all of a sudden, I go, what am I doing? I have a dime, you know. So I just went around the corner and I just stood against the wall and I just prayed that the guy didn't show up, you know. But anyhow, I was a Pinkerton guard and I was assigned to this guy because he was going out doing something or whatever, and I went with him. And anyhow, we got to talking and I asked him how he got started, a little bit like you're asking me. And I asked him what advice he had. And he said, when I was your age, I was just getting started in photography. And there was a guy like me back then who I really admired. And so I took some pictures and I put them in a portfolio and I sent them to him and I said, I want to be a photographer. Am I any good? You know, tell me if I'm any good. And he said he got back a letter that he always cherished ever since then. He got his pictures back and he got a handwritten note from this guy. And the note said basically, dear such and such, thank you for sending me your pictures. I can see by your work that you've mastered the basics of a camera and photography. Now I suggest you surround yourself with the best books, music, dance, art, cinema, poetry that you can find, and everything else will take care of itself. And to this day, that's still, to me, the best advice that I could ever give a young artist. If you osmositize, or whatever the word is, yourself with good art of all kinds, you want to be a writer, don't just write. Listen to music. There's a rhythm to writing, you know. Watch dance or whatever. There's, you know, you learn how to describe photography. You'll understand colors and you can relate to them. There's many, many things that tie into writing. I always, when I write, I always do this because I'm come from a musical background and I always have a song in my head. Even as I'm talking to you, I have a song in my
head.
What's
the song? I'm afraid to ask.
The heat is on. I don't know why. It's just, it's in the back of my head. I can hear it. It's like somebody forgot to turn the radio off. It, always, always, all day long. I wake up, there's a song in my head. I go to bed, there's a song in my head. So I always go like this when I'm writing. And my wife has observed that when I stop, she said, what's going on right now? Because she'll sit, she'll watch me. Right? And she said, what's going on? I said, I'm stuck. She said, see, that's why you stopped. When you do like this, it's going good. And when you stop, you're stuck. And the rhythm of writing, and the reason that you can go from like the top to the bottom of some people's writing and it really flows really nicely and you're done, and other people you have to stop and read the same thing over and over again, and it's one page, but that rhythm, which has a lot to do with how many words in a sentence and where you put your periods and how you put your commas and things like that, is very musical. So if you learn the beats and things about music, you could end up being a very good writer. So my long-winded answer is exactly what, you know, this gentleman, the photographer, told me. Surround yourself with all those good things, including good writing. And if you want to be a sports writer, don't just read sports writers. You know, read novelists, read Read, you know, nonfiction narrative. Read comic books. Read anything. You will pick up something from all of those things.
Mitch, I want to thank WPHT and Cindy Webster in particular. You met her. She was in hot pants from the Eagles game, or a miniskirt. She's somewhere around
here. Was that a prerequisite?
I want to thank Mike Baldini for all his work in support of Book Club. I want to thank Greg Stocker and David Uram, who are associated with my radio program. And last but not least, I happen to have the number one radio producer in all of America, in TC, and she is somewhere here. Thank you, TC. I get the final question. I'm sure as you sign books, if people have a question or two, you'd be thrilled to answer
sure.
that. Thank you so much, by the way. You are such a great conversationalist. You do so many things well, and I really appreciate your time here tonight. What's next on the horizon in terms of books for Mitch Albom?
Well, there's two that I'm considering. One is a book about Haiti and the experiences that we've had down there. They've been very life-changing in terms of my view of how humanity treats humanity. I have sat across the table from people who come to give us their children. It has been the most eye-opening thing that I've ever done in terms of, like, I live in one world, and wow, this whole world is going on, and I never knew about it. And I actually have to make the decisions as to which children that we will admit. And people will come in from circumstances that are beyond description. All of them, the base level, live in tents of corrugated tin that are basically like a teepee with a tarp thrown over it. The floors are always dirt or mud. In many cases where we've gone out and see where they live, there'll be a big pig or a wild boar lapping up the water. And on the other end of this puddle will be a child, you know, a 6-month-old infant, naked, sitting in the same water this pig is lapping up. We've had a woman come in, and she was pregnant out to here, so near to bursting that she could barely walk, barefoot. She had a 6-year-old boy with her and a 2-year-old in her arms. She said to me that she wanted to give us, she says me, but she doesn't, you know, she means the place, her 6-year-old. I said, why? She said, I can't afford to feed him or school him or take care of him. I said, why are you pregnant? She said, well, I was hoping to get a man to take care of these other two. I said, and so you let him get you pregnant? She said, yeah. I said, and what happened to the man? He's gone. I said, well, what's going to happen to that baby? She said, you can have him too. And this is a daily conversation. And trying to make a decision about what child you may end up saving, because really that's kind of the difference. Wow. You hear about people dying in Haiti all the time there, as if they were the way that we talk about, I don't know, somebody getting a job or having a small accident. Oh, my sister died. Your sister died? Yes, last week. She just died? Yes. What was the matter? She got sick and she died. What do you mean she got sick and she died? She was not feeling well and then she died. Did you take her to the hospital? Well, we took her, but they wouldn't take her, and then she died on the way home. That's it? That's all you know? Yes. When's the funeral? Tomorrow. No explanation. It's not like here, you know, cause of death, certificates, examinations. It's nothing. People just die. They die on the way to hospitals. They die in the car. They die waiting outside. You can't be seen unless you have money. It's not like here. There's no emergency rooms. You know, there are a handful of volunteer hospitals, but for the most part, you know, they're stuffed up. They close. So that whole experience of sort of seeing children and living with them, and you think you're making a difference. And there's this one little boy, Rosie knows him, he's been down. There's one little boy, Appleus is his name. We call him Applesauce. He's this, the cutest kid that you could possibly imagine. When I started going down there, he was this high and he was 6 years old because he was so malnourished. And of course, we fed him, and he's grown, and he's now, you know, almost a regular size, and he's 8. And the last time I was down there, I said to him, "Apollos, he can now speak English, you know, which he never could before." I said, "Apollos, I got something to show you. I have a film from when I first came, and I'm going to show you some pictures of when you and me first met." And he was so excited. And I let him come up to this little area on this porch where the kids are not allowed. You know, it's the adults are up there and the kids are all down. But this was a very special moment for him. So he got to come upstairs. He was more excited about that than seeing these pictures. And he came upstairs and he saw the pictures, you know, and he was laughing and everything. And I said, "Okay, now I'm going to take you back to the bed," because all the other kids were in bed. I walked him, and I noticed he just let me have his one hand, but I didn't really pay much attention, but it just, you know, a lot of times they'll want to be held or jump in your arms or whatever, but I was holding his one hand, and we walked back to the bedroom, and the other boys were still awake, and it was a big deal because Apollos had gotten to go up to this thing. And I said, "All right, everybody go to sleep, you know," I said, "good night," and all of a sudden the boys start saying, Mr. Mitch, look at Apollos, look at what Apollos has. And I looked over, and he had hidden a cup of water while he was up there, because we have a little water dispenser, you know, like an office water dispenser. And he had taken and hidden it under his shirt to have some water to drink at night. And they were telling on him because, you know, they were mad that he got this special thing. I just started to cry because I thought, 2 years, look at you're so busy congratulating yourself on how good you've done. And you still, kids think that they have to steal water in order, you know, they can't even tell you that they're taking water. And it just tells you how much work you have to do. And so that kind of, all those kind of experiences, I think would make an interesting, but I don't want to write about the history of Haiti. I don't know anything about it. And you can't save that country. And I've said it a million times. You can only save a piece of it, you know. But if you find your little piece and somebody else finds their piece, whatever, that's, you know, you add them together, maybe you make some kind of dent. So I might write about that. And the other thing is a novel about envy. I think that envy is ruining this country, ruining our lives. I think that it is becoming a preeminent emotion. I think the whole basis of reality television and this whole celebrity culture is basically somebody has what I don't have and I want it. This whole notion of game shows where if you compete, you can win and you can be that person, you can sing and now you can be a star, you can try out and now you can, you know, everything is about, you know, hitting it big so that you can be that other person. And I think we're so motivated by trying to be the other person or trying to have what the other person has, and the anger that exists in this country between the classes and between races and between ethnicities and all this stuff about perceiving that someone else has what they don't have. Envy is, as that old expression says, like drinking poison and hoping the other guy dies. And I really think that there's something to say about that. So if I can find, I don't know, a ghost or heaven, or I always seem to turn to ghosts. I don't know. Maybe I won't do a ghost this time. But if I can find a mechanism by which to tell that, it's something that I want to touch on. It's something that I have experience with on both ends of it. I think I've gotten to the point where I have put it in its place. But it's one of those things that I want to always remind myself of, to never be envious of anybody. And to, you know, maybe for me, one of the best ways to do that is to write a book. So that's what I might do.
Thank you for coming to Book Club.
You're welcome.